Hello, and welcome to the CISC podcast. In each edition of this series, you'll have the chance to meet a CISC staff member or other educational professional involved with the CISC community. We think you will find these podcasts of great value as a variety of people share their unique insights in their respective fields. Now, please enjoy this edition of the podcast as our host, Bob Kretzmer, speaks with our guest.
In this episode of the CISC podcast, we continue our discussion with Daniel Baer via Skype and take a deeper dive into some of the complexities of the government code. In particular, we thank frontline employees charged with the responsibility of reviewing documents that look like claim for damages will be very interested in this episode. Daniel provides concrete examples and clear explanations which will further your understanding. We hope you enjoy listening to this conversation.
Going further and a little bit deeper into our discussion, Daniel, I wanted to ask you, if a claim is deemed insufficient, what are the options for response by the public entity?
Well, one response is to ignore the deficiency and just respond to the claim as is. And if you do that, you risk waiving whatever the insufficiency is. And it might be an insufficiency that invalidates the claim so that it can't serve as a valid basis for a lawsuit. But if you don't point that out to the claimant, you waive it. To not waive it, you have to serve a notice within 20 days of the claim's presentation that the claim is insufficient. We call it a notice of insufficiency. If the claim is electronically presented and there's a change in the law recently that says that an entity can expressly authorize by resolution or ordinance that a claim can be presented electronically, and it will specify the manner for presenting it electronically, usually be by email or on a website. If the claim is electronically presented, you can send the notice of insufficiency to the email address from which the claim was sent or any alternative email address that the claimant requests.
Going back to our school district scenario, in our discussion about who the claim must be filed with, who are the appropriate people or offices at a school district, Daniel, that you think a government claim must be filed with? Can you comment on that?
Well, it's not just what I think, it's actually what is prescribed by statute, specifically Government Code Section 915. And as I mentioned, it is very strict, and there's a good reason for that. The good reason is that there's so many documents that can be act as claims as presented that don't meet all of the requirements for a claim, but still have to be treated as a claim. And it's important that they all go to a specified place so that the custodian doesn't receive a letter that's later treated as a claim against the district. So how you can present a claim depends on how you present it. If you're personally delivering it, you're taking it there yourself, or you're sending a messenger, a courier, it can go to the clerk, the secretary for the district. It can also go to an auditor, but probably the district's not going to have an auditor. If you're mailing the claim, it can be mailed to the clerk or secretary of the school district, or, and this is probably more common, it can be mailed to the governing body of the district, such as the board, at its principal address. And as I mentioned, the law has recently been changed so that the district can set up by resolution a system for electronically receiving claims, such as over a website or by email. And this is important. If the board has not, or the district has not set up this system for electronically receiving claims, a claimant cannot present the claim by emailing it in or faxing it in or posting it to the Facebook page of the district or some other means. It has to either be presented in person by personal delivery or by U.S. postal mail. Or in the mail, they could probably fudge in a third-party courier such as FedEx or UPS. That might be deemed personal delivery. But still, the government code does not permit electronic presentation of claims unless the entity, the district, has expressly permitted it.
So, Daniel, when you refer to the, or when the government code refers to the clerk or secretary at the district, are we talking about Lois sitting at the front desk of the district office? Is that who you mean by clerk or secretary, or are you talking about something more formal in terms of a position that has that title?
It's usually something more formal. It's the a public agency or a clerk or a public agency or a school district or an entity will usually designate somebody as the clerk of the district, or there may be an office of the secretary of the district, and that's what's meant. And perhaps there may be people working for that there may be an office of the clerk, and somebody, and Lois may be sitting at the front desk of that office. If so, presentation to that person is probably going to be viewed as presentation to the clerk. The same thing for a secretary. So we're looking more in terms of who is employed or who holds the office of a clerk or secretary. But if you've got a window for that particular office holder, then receipt by that person will probably be deemed sufficient.
So what happens when a person files a government claim that is determined to be late beyond the date of presentation? What happens?
It depends on whether the claim is presented by itself or with an application for leave to present a late claim. If the claim is presented by itself and the district determines it wasn't presented within the 6 months or 1 year, whichever applies to that type of claim, it generally has to let the presenter know that it was late. If it was a claim that's covered by the 6 month statute, it has to send a specific notice, the contents of which are prescribed by Government Code Section 911.3. And it has to send that notice within 45 days of receipt, plus 5 if it's received by mail, or if it's received by electronic means by 2 extra court days. In other words, the time for the entity to respond to the claim. If it doesn't, the entity waives the defense that the claim is untimely. The entity can agree to extend that time, but if it's not within that extended time or the 45 days plus 5 if it's mailed, the untimeliness is waived. For the 1 year, the statute I mentioned doesn't apply, but there's still cases that say that you got to let the presenter know that the claim is untimely, or you may waive the late claim defense. If the claim is accompanied by an application for leave to present a late claim, you don't have to send that notice to preserve the late claim defense, because the notice that you send essentially tells the person your only choice is to apply for leave to present a late claim. If they've already presented a late claim, then that's not necessary. What you do need to do is respond to the application for leave to present a late claim. And if it shows good cause for presenting the claim late, the district can grant the application and accept the claim. The claim is deemed presented on the date that the application is granted, and then respond to the claim. It can deny the claim on the merits, or it can let the claim expire by operation of law by not responding within the 45 days. Or it can deny application, deny leave, either by sending a notice saying we deny the application, or by not acting on the application within 45 days plus 5 if it's mailed, and then it's denied by operation of law. If the application is denied, then the final option for the person who is presenting the late claim is to petition the superior court, the trial court, for relief from the claim statutes. And that's under Government Code Section 946.6. A necessary prerequisite for the claimant to petition under 946.6 is that the application for leave to present a late claim, if this is a claim that's governed by the six-month statute, has to be made within 1 year of accrual. If it's not made within 1 year of accrual, or one of the statutory exceptions to that 1 year, the tolling provisions provide apply, then the trial court has no power to grant relief, and the person is barred. And the only relief they may have is if they're represented by counsel who blew the deadline, they may have a malpractice lawsuit against their counsel.
When there is a hearing for a petition for late claim relief, is the district allowed to have representation at that hearing?
Absolutely. A petition for leave to present a late claim is essentially a mini lawsuit. It's what's called a special proceeding, which so it's not quite like a general action which you bring by filing a complaint. It's a special proceeding that is brought by filing a petition. It includes representation on both sides, or the opportunity for representation. A claimant can still pursue a petition in pro per without an attorney. It will involve a hearing on the petition, which is held pretty much like a motion hearing. There won't be live witnesses. There is presentation of evidence by both sides, which is generally done by declarations presented by both sides and documentary evidence. The parties may take discovery. They may do depositions or send written discovery, interrogatories, requests for production. They will present that in the petitioner or opening brief and a respondent's brief and a reply brief. And then there will be a hearing by the court at which the court will grant, will either grant or deny the petition and set forth an order. If the court grants the petition, the claimant has 30 days from the date the petition is granted to file suit. It's basically a new statute of limitations to file suit. If it's denied, the claimant can file an appeal from the denial. And there can be a situation where the claimant contends the claim was timely and is just petitioning for safety reasons to deal with the contention that the claim is untimely. In that situation, if the petition is denied, it does not prevent the claimant from going ahead and filing a lawsuit and alleging in the lawsuit that the claim was originally timely. And if the trier of fact agrees they've proved the claim is timely, it doesn't matter that the district contended it was untimely. The party can go ahead and proceed in their lawsuit on the ground that they've presented a timely claim.
Can a claim for damages or government claim be both insufficient and late?
Sure. And an example is, as I've mentioned, there can be claims presented. In other words, the claim is a letter saying Johnny fell in the playground, give me $100,000 or I'll file suit. It may not have all of the elements in that are required by Government Code Section 910, so it's insufficient. And it was filed 7 months after Johnny fell down, and there's no reason why the notice of the district allegedly doing something wrong was delayed, so it's untimely. So it's both insufficient and untimely. But if the district doesn't send a notice of insufficiency within 20 days, they waive that insufficiency. And if they don't send the Government Code Section 911.3 notice of untimeliness within 45 days, they waive the untimeliness. So both insufficiency and untimeliness have to be preserved by the right notifications, or else they don't matter. They can't be raised as defenses. The defenses are waived.
So you mentioned earlier there are certain types of matters that do not require the filing of a government claim, Daniel. Could you give a few examples or a couple examples of what those matters are?
Sure, and the best place to look for a list, and it's a long list, although it's not necessarily a comprehensive list, is Government Code Section 905. It generally lists a bunch of types of claims that don't require a written claim for damages. For instance, I'm calling them claim for damages because they're only necessary when the claimant is going to sue for damages. If they're suing for a different kind of relief, such as purely injunctive relief, they don't need a claim. If they're suing for return of particular items that were seized and those items were destroyed, so they're going to seek the value of those items from the district, they don't have to present a claim because it's the same as if they were asking for the return of the items. If they're going to sue under a federal statute, particularly something like the IDEA, the Special Education Statute, or the Rehabilitation Act, or the General Civil Rights Statute 42 USC Section 1983, they do not have to present a claim because the state requirements for suing don't apply to those federal statutes. If they are suing for childhood sexual assault claims, that would be covered by Code of Civil Procedures Section 340.1. In other words, they're an adult suing for sexual assault that happened as a child, and they're suing the district for not preventing this, or if it's a minor who's suing for sexual assault, they don't have to present a claim. It was excluded from the Government Claims Act by various statutes, most recently AB 218, which passed in 2019 and became effective last year, and is retroactive to any claim pending as of January 1st, 2020, excluding any childhood sexual assault claims from the need to present a claim for damages before suing for the assault. If one public entity is suing another public entity, and the public entity that sued doesn't have a charter requirement or some other requirement that another public entity present claims, no claim is necessary. And one that can pop up for school districts is Education Code Section 49013 claims for reimbursement of pupil fees for educational activities. Don't have to present a claim for that. And if a public employee, a district employee, has a claim for fees, salaries, wages, mileage, other expenses, and allowances, they don't have to present a claim to sue for that.
Daniel, is there anything else you would like our audience to know about claim filings that might be key to their role of being that frontline person receiving claim forms or letters that might look like a claim?
Yes, and that is to know the basic rules and to be careful, because a document that looks like a claim may not be a claim. A document that doesn't look like a claim may eventually be treated as a claim. So you have to be alert for claims that come in that look like claims. You have to be alert for correspondence that comes in that doesn't look like a claim, but still gives the enough of information that a claim for damage is being made and a lawsuit will be filed if it is not acted upon, that it'll be treated as a claim. Because as I've mentioned, there are these deadlines to respond to the claims. You have 20 days, very short time, to send a notice of insufficiency. You have 45 days, plus five if it's mailed, to respond with a notice of untimeliness, or to contact the claimant and ask for more time to investigate it. And if you just put this document aside and don't act on it, your district could lose the opportunity to defend an action on a procedural ground that it could have preserved. And most important, if you have some doubt about it, it's a good idea to contact CISC and ask for their expertise in addressing this document and letting them know that there's this document that should, that could be a claim that has to be acted on.
Well, Daniel, we thank you for your time and your expertise. You've been a wonderful and important resource to CISC over the years, and we are going to continue to tap into all of your knowledge related to not only the government code, but all the other special matters we check in with you on. And thank you again for your time, and it's been a fascinating discussion. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of the CISC podcast and greatly appreciate you listening to our show. Please check the CISC property and liability website at cisc.kern.org for a complete listing of podcast topics under the property and liability tab. Until next time, stay safe as we continue with the CISC mission of schools helping schools.
Production facilities for the CISC podcast are provided by KETN, a service of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools.